Let's be honest. How many times have you chalked up a relationship ending to bad timing? For hosts Nancy and PJ Heslin, the answer is a lot. It took living separately in Canada, the US, and France, two divorces, and 20 years for timing to work out. And when it finally did in the south of France, the couple discovered they had two different versions of their love story. We all do, right? But what if your side is not the whole story and you have the journals to prove it? Keep listening to Nancy and PJ Finally Get Together, a podcast on love, relationships, and two lives in between.
This episode is brought to you by the Panlagos Foundation. Panlagos is based in New York City, and they are a nonprofit cultural organization founded on the ideals of Hellenism, dedicated to the betterment of humanity by supporting intercultural dialogue and exchange through the Hellenic language, education, and ideals, providing opportunities for the pursuit of excellence to individuals of all ages and backgrounds, bringing the wisdom of the past in dialogue with the present. We aim to inspire a happier, healthier humanity for today and the future.
Welcome to episode 5 of Nancy and PJ Finally Get Together. I'm Nancy Heslin.
And I'm PJ Heslin.
First of all, let us just, I never know how to start these things. Before we get into-
You always look confused, like, what are we doing again?
Before we get into the episode, just wanted to say how grateful and humble we are that we reached 1,000 downloads in 10 days. What do you think about that, PJ? I added an applause effect because after listening to PJ and his stand-up stories, I thought maybe he missed a...
We just got effect. This little mixing board and all of these little effects Nancy's been playing with. So it's very amusing to me to see her playing with this new toy.
But anyway, we are excited about having that
many
incredible.
People. I literally thought at the height of this success, 500 people at most would be listening to it or downloading it.
Over so 10 years you're talking about.
Yes, over 10 years.
For me, the big bonus was my niece in Australia sent a text on WhatsApp to say she had binged listened on her commute to Sydney, the 4 episodes that we launched. So I was really excited because I always think of like binge something is always with Netflix. So maybe Ben and Jerry's will come up with an ice cream for us. Not Netflix and chill, but what would they call an ice cream for our podcast, PJ?
Tubby and skinny. I'm tubby, you're skinny.
That's our TV series, but that's to come. Anyway, so as you'll have noticed by now, we are launching or releasing 2 episodes a month on the 11th of every month, and that on the 23rd, we're doing special guest episodes, which is a fantastic way to just share other couples' experiences. We're hoping to have not just expat couples from this part of the world, but all kinds of people doing cool things so that you don't just have to listen to us. Let's recap where we left off last episode. Winter 1992. I was 23. PJ was 27. And we had known each other for about 2.5 years. And about 6 months before we get to the next big defining moment in our relationship, PJ and I had sort of reconciled after France. I was going to say Paris, but I'd never lived in Paris.
Nope.
I'd been in the south of France. He sort of proposed marriage. It ended. The whole proposal, I just blew.
Wait a minute. Who were you dating in Paris then?
I don't know. So we've now known each other about 2.5 years. I'm living in Mont-Joli, teaching English as a second language. For those that are not familiar with Quebec, it's up in the Gaspésie region, sort of maybe 4 hours northeast of Quebec City, east of Rimouski, if you know Rimouski. And it was amazing, though, because it was on the shore of the St. Lawrence River, and that was pretty spectacular. But it was a small town. I was living in the middle of nowhere. I think it was a population of 6,000, maybe 6,200 people. And my folks had driven me there that fall. And even then, when they pulled up, there was already snow in October. And there was one strip mall, one main road. And when we pulled up that main road and all I saw, the one restaurant was a patio pizza or pizza patio, I really almost vomited.
Describe how long and cold the winters are there.
So later that winter, we had 3 weeks of minus 45 degrees. Including wind chill. So that would be, even when I stepped outside, I was completely covered up. But my eyes, obviously, I had to see. But the wind would hit your eyes and you'd have tear up in your eyes and they just turned to icicles immediately. But to give you an idea of really how small town this was, because it's important to understand the difference of where PJ was at starting his comedy in a big city and myself living in a pretty isolated part of the world, I was teaching at three primary schools, and I would say each one had less than 100 students. And one of the schools was super remote. And I can remember one of the French teachers drove me there every Thursday, I think it was, for the English classes. And when I first walked into this little house on the prairie school, I looked down and there were these sort of shoes with someone with anisomalia, you know, someone with one leg longer than the other. And I saw these shoes lined up and I thought, what's going on? And then one of the three teachers that was permanently there kind of walked over to me, and I realized quickly that she had one leg longer than the other. But even as I say that, when I say the word anisomalia, I realize that semelle is the French word for insole. And so I realize now where that word comes from. But
well done.
It only took me 30 years. I was living a really isolated life. It was freezing. Nobody spoke English. The French they spoke wasn't even like real French. They would say a word, I'd look it up in the dictionary, and you know, you need a Quebecois dictionary to live in that part of Quebec. But that at that time, and one of the things that we really wanted to emphasize in these podcasts is life before internet, mobile phones, social media. So today, if I had this type of relationship with PJ, I'd be watching him on social media and trying to see what he's doing or where he's at. But then all you had was, I don't even know, fax machines, but all
they
you had...
There were fax machines,
but you're faxing
but you can't
each other.
Search yeah. for somebody on a
What's
fax machine.
What's he doing machine? By fax? Bzzz. And all you had was music and memories and your mind. And I have a very creative mind, and I would listen to Sinead O'Connor, This is the Last Day of Our Acquaintance, anything from the Wild at Heart soundtrack, but in particular, Chris Isaak, what's that song, Wicked Game. Hmm. Anything from George Michael, Freedom, but, you know, because that was sort of an anthem album of the time. The Black Crowes, I was listening to Thorn in My Pride. And I would listen to those songs repeatedly, and relive everything that's happened with PJ and relive everything I wanted to happen. And, you know, compare that to now. I mean, I really had no way of reaching him other than hoping he received my letter by post and never really knowing, is he going to reply and buy a stamp?
And even... getting somebody by post, I moved around a lot. You know, I was in my 20s and you'd live in a place for, I don't know, it wasn't even a year total. And then you'd move somewhere else. And
it wasn't really that. It was the fact that I couldn't really see you buying a stamp.
Yeah.
That seemed like a bigger challenge. But if you compare that and that type of living to now, just recently when I was looking through my first journal to do some of the notes for the show, I actually found the class list from my immersion program of May and June in 1990, where PJ and I met. And we had all handwritten our names and addresses to share as a class. And there were three people there that I really would love to make contact with, I guess is what you say. And I looked up one of them because they have a unique name. And within 5 minutes, I found her. And after 32 years, we're back in touch. I mean, life is just so different with... And it's good and bad, but, you know, when you're in your head a lot, it can be just torturous.
For me, there's a couple of people I'd like to make contact with, but I'm far too lazy.
PJ's just lazy.
Even in the internet age, for me to type in Ian, John, French Immersion Program, too much work.
Yeah.
Far too much work.
And so that is all just to say that we did have these, I would say, real contrasts in our lives. And the other thing I realized, though... And this is the whole idea of sharing two stories. Even though I had my journals and I've gone back and reread them, even my recollection of what happened was wrong. For example, so here I am living in Quebec in the middle of nowhere. And all I can think about is PJ's invited me to go see him do his stand-up comedy at Yuk Yuk's. First of all, in my mind, I thought this was the first time ever he was doing stand-up. And it dawned on me that in all the 6 months leading to that, PJ had been working on his stand-up career, launching it, doing those things. I had never asked him one question in the few times that we had spoken by phone or connected. I never knew what he was doing. I never asked questions. In my mind, all that mattered in his life to me was, when was he going to tell me that he still loved me?
In fact, didn't you just realize this when we were working on the podcast?
Yeah.
That it was, oh, I didn't know you were doing stand-up.
I was like, so by the way, what was your first stand-up? And some of it I read when he wrote his side of the book and we were putting the editing together, I saw some of the first moments, but I'd never asked him. So as much as I loved blaming him for the demise of our relationship and for his big head, I think I was just as egotistical in my own mind. But
look, my ego is still healthy, very healthy.
Yeah, and mine maybe not as much. But all I could think about was telling PJ I love him, but he had this whole world in Toronto going on, and that was stand-up comedy. Yeah. What was the first time you did stand-up? Where was that?
It was at a club called The Laugh Resort.
Because I think people think it's pretty easy just to stand up on a stage and maybe talk for a few minutes, tell a few jokes.
Do you really? I think that's one of the greatest fears people have is just speaking in public.
Really? Because I see so many shows now about stand-up and people thinking that that's the career they want to do because comedy has sort of embraced more elements than just stand-up.
Yeah, I think stand-up now is much more normalized in society. I mean, you can study it in college. There's now classes that you can take to do stand-up. It's much more, it's a mainstream thing. But back then, it wasn't mainstream. It was certainly known about because there was a comedy boom in the late 80s, thanks to cable television and their need for content. They put on these, you know, stand-up shows, which was cheap and easy to get content.
Is that when Kids in the Hall started? Late
80s? I think Kids in the Stall.
that's their
lesser known alternative sketch show. Kids in the Hall started 89, I believe. Okay. I think that was their first air date. But they weren't popular till about early 90s. They were on HBO and then on CBC after that.
They were on CBC after HBO?
Yep, I believe, if I'm correct. Yeah.
You may not be.
And I might not be.
I'm pretty sure you're not, but we'll just pretend you are. That's so interesting, PJ. Wow, you're so knowledgeable.
But they were a big deal because they had started in Toronto at a little club called the Rivoli, which would have music and comedy as well, which I used to perform there as well.
One of the best clubs in Toronto.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Thank God it's still open. COVID didn't shut it down. But yeah, I started at a little club called the Laugh Resort in Toronto. Now, at the time, there were two clubs in Toronto to do stand-up. One was the Laugh Resort, which was just an independent club. And then you had Yuck Yucks, which was this big, huge North American franchise of comedy clubs.
But what was Second City then?
Okay, so Second City was improvised comedy.
In Toronto.
Yeah, Second City, for those of you who know comedy, would know Second City, famous. John Candy started there, Harold Ramis, all those.
Catherine O'Hara.
Gilda Radner, Catherine O'Hara. Yeah, all those. Dan Aykroyd. Anyway, famous. So yeah, that's Andrew improv Martin. Comedy. And stand-up comedy is different. Improv, you do with a group of people. You work on suggestions from the audience and you sort of come up with a show and stand-up.
Our relationship was a little bit of improv comedy, wasn't it, in the end?
And then stand-up comedy is just a guy getting up there. And yes, it is usually a guy back in the 90s was one person telling jokes. And at the time in Toronto, there was this real dichotomy. And it was almost like the Sharks versus the Jets. Like you either did improv or you did stand-up. And I just thought, God, why do one, you know, I took classes at the Laugh Resort and met a lot of the guys and girls who were doing comedy at Second City. And then also knew the guys and gals at doing stand-up. And, you know, I used to get flack from my stand-up comedian friends because they were like, hey, what are you doing improv? And I used to just think, look, if the worst problem we have in society is improv versus stand-up, that's a pretty good society. So that's where I started, the Laugh Resort. And also, Kids in the Hall used to come down to the Laugh Resort, so it had a sort of bump from those guys as well.
What do you mean a bump?
A bump, like that sort of made it popular, is that, oh, wow.
Because they were hanging out.
Yeah, like, oh, Dave Foley and Dave, I remember Dave, there was some article on the Star, I think, Toronto Star, where Dave spoke about the Laugh Resort, so it had a good reputation. And the comedy there was really, I thought, was really good. It was clean. We were all trying to do something unique.
So what happened the first time that they called your name, you're sitting in the audience, you know that you're going to be on stage for 5 minutes, right?
Yeah. So back then, I'm sure it's still the same way, but you would phone in when you're starting off, you'd phone into a comedy club and they had open mic nights. Usually it was a slow night during the week, like a Tuesday or Sunday or whatever. You'd phone in, get your name on a list, and then the booker would phone you back. So, you know, when I was in Toronto, phoned Yuck Yucks and the Laugh Resort. But Yuck Yucks, being the more famous club, had a much longer waiting list. So Laugh Resort got back to me first. And yeah, I went down and prepared some things to say. And at that time, before I did stand up, I thought, you know, when those guys get up on stage, they're just coming up the top of their head. Like it's they're not writing
gifted.
Yeah, it was, oh my God, how they can be that funny just off the top of their head for 20 minutes to an hour and a half. And once I started doing it, realized, oh no. They do the stuff over and over again, perfect it, and then, you know, try to write new stuff and add to it. So fortunately, I realized, well, I'm not gifted where I can just come up with 5 minutes off the top of my head. So I came up with some jokes that I thought were funny. And
I still think they're funny.
Gathered, it was 10 to 15 of my friends, and I was very confident. I just thought,
You know, confident? It's so hard to imagine. PJ.
I just said, oh my God, this is good. I'm going to be so great. And this is just, well, as soon as I do this 5 minutes, I'll be whisked off and then I'll have my own special, probably in a week or so. And I'll probably be on Friends by the end of the month. Not as bad as that, but no, I was confident going down.
So what happened when you're in the audience? I know that you weren't first on stage because you said, I remember you telling me that the person in front of I think it was a man in front of you performing, was bombing and was sucking the air out of the room. So tell people about the feeling of bombing.
Yeah, so I went down and sitting there in the audience, and the way the amateur night works is they have the pro comic goes up and he warms up the audience and then he brings up the acts. So the first act went up and the poor guy, I mean, just bombed. And it's a feeling of half the audience feels sorry for him and then half the audience hates him.
I'm sure people listening have been in this situation, right?
Stand-up
comedy is so popular.
Done a speech or a, you know,
it's almost like your face burns for the person that's performing. You feel so badly.
Yeah, if you have an ounce of humanity in you, you just feel so sorry for that person. And I quickly realized, oh, I'm next.
So what happened when they called your name?
I did not want to go up. I did not want to go up because all of a sudden that confidence turned into just white knuckled fear. And I started to get literally tunnel vision, which I've never had before in my life. Just, you know, the darkness around my eyes started to get bigger and bigger. And the comic called my name to go on stage. And had I not been there with so many friends, I wouldn't have gone up because I was that terrified. And I had no choice. My friends were, hey, get up. And I'm literally looking around like, who's this PJ guy they're calling? I don't know.
It's so weird to imagine.
Oh, I just, just terrified.
So what happened when you went up?
Went up, tunnel vision started to get worse and worse. Get up on stage. And now when you're on stage in a comedy club, there's a very bright light in your eye. So you really don't see the audience. You kind of see, you know, heads in the first row, but you just see a bright, it's literally like deer in the headlight. So I just said the first joke and fortunately it got a laugh.
From your friends?
even more than my friends. There was probably about 100, 150 people in the audience. So yeah, my friends weren't.
How many people lived in the town where I was staying?
My friends weren't the majority of the audience, but I'm sure that helped. Then slowly that tunnel vision went away and started to relax into it and said the rest of my jokes and didn't get carried off on the shoulders, but did get laughs.
Does it feel as though the 5 minutes just go on forever?
Or
does it actually go quickly?
Yeah, no, I lost track of time. I didn't, you know, I sort of had my jokes planned. And the way it works is the booking manager will switch a red light on and off that's at the back of the room. So when you go on, he says, oh, you know, look for the red light. Well, of course, you're blinded by this big white light. And I finish my jokes and I'm looking for this red light and I couldn't see it. And finally, I just see this little, you know, red thing going. I'm like, okay, that's my time. Goodbye.
Did people applaud then?
Like, yeah, I got applause. And
how did you feel?
Oh, like
walking off that stage.
Like I dodged a bullet. Like just, and yeah, just number one. Relief of like, okay, that's over. And also, hey, I got laughs. And that feeling of getting laughs from strangers, I mean, it is such a buzz. when a set goes great, there's no better feeling. And you just...
Really? No better feeling? Really? I'm right here.
Okay. Yes, there are better feelings. A different better feeling. So, yeah, it's... and the thing, you know, you're doing it at night, so you get that adrenaline rush. And you see so many nights not going to bed till, you know, 5, 6 in the morning.
So, wait, I just have a question. I don't mean to interrupt you, but... So
but you did.
Before, I might... But in the last episodes, you said, you know, you wanted to be a professor, but didn't really get into that. And then you also were interested in journalism, but that didn't really work out. So when you did that set for the first time, when you came off the set at the stage, did you think, oh, I finally figured out what I want to do?
Well, I'd already known that the reason I was doing stand-up was because I wanted to be a writer. So that's what I saw as a venue for getting into writing was, okay, if I can, you know, get people to see me do stand-up, if I could make a living, I didn't even think I could make a living at it.
You're not very
good
looking, so I couldn't imagine you on TV or anything.
But I did not think you could make a living at stand-up. It was a very weird, odd, not a mainstream type of thing. And so, yeah, I thought, oh, okay, well, maybe I can parlay this somehow into eventually writing for a TV show. And the dream was Saturday Night Live. If I could either be on Saturday Night Live or write for Saturday Night Live, which in a future episode we'll see. I have an audition for. Ooh. But that was the goal. Can I do stand up and parlay that into writing?
So when we met up December to see you, it was December 22nd, 1992, when I came down from Quebec to see you do your first time at Yuk Yuk's.
Yeah.
So in those 6 months from the time that you did the first stand up, you were and that was, you know, that was just an open mic night. You started already getting paid for gigs before the Yuk Yuk's night?
Yeah. So I had, like I said, started at the Laugh Resort. By the time I did Yuk Yuk's, I'd been at the Laugh Resort for about 6 months and I just started to get paid gigs. So doing, you know, a Thursday night.
Is that still like 5 minutes or is that like
no,
the whole
it's a
night?
Little bit longer. You do probably 8 minutes or so, 5 to 8 minutes.
Did they pay
the
you
top.
In chicken wings and beer or did they actually pay you?
Well, you'd end up just paying. Well, the Laugh Resort had a great setup. It was a 3-story building downtown Toronto. And the top floor was the comedy club, which was a beautiful setup for a comedy club. Nice, intimate space, low ceilings. Comics know what I'm talking about. Then below that, they had a bar called Milwaukee's, which had great chicken wings and beers from all over the world. And then the bottom floor was a slightly classier restaurant as well. And yeah, you got paid for a spot, maybe, God, I don't know, if you're opening 20, 30 bucks, but of course you'd go down to Milwaukee's right after and spend it on chicken wings and draft beer.
So when we got together, you know, and again, I say this because I never asked PJ in all the years we've been together until recently, I never asked him any of the questions about the early days of his stand-up. And I didn't note it in my journal or I noted other things as the year went on, as the years went by and his career developed. I have all that stuff written, but for some reason I've blocked out this beginning part of your career. So we met the night of Yuk Yuk's. I came down to Toronto. I met him, I think, at his house and I met you at your apartment and you were really quiet. And I remember thinking how strange that was because you are always talking. PJs are always talking.
Or singing.
There's a lot of singing that goes on. But I felt a bit strange or uncomfortable because, again, I would have blamed everything on him. But now I reread everything and see how selfish I was going, why isn't he paying attention to me the first night he's going to do stand-up at this new club? My heart was racing when I saw him on stage because it's like anything that you support somebody that you love, whether it's stand-up comedy or music or anything that they do, that they put themselves out there. You just want them to succeed and do well because you just love them so much. And I was sitting in the table in the front row with his mom and his sister and one of his camp friends. It was just it was one of those nights that stand out in all the years we were together because everything just went swimmingly. It was fun. The energy was fantastic. PJ was really funny. The audience laughed and was engaged, but not laugh like really enjoyed it. And then after the performance, we all hung out at the bar. And PJ was a little bit touchy-feely with me, and that felt really nice because I'd been living in the middle of nowhere. I had nobody to touch me or talk to me. And I had been waiting to tell him that I loved him. That was the whole thing for the fall of 1992, that while he was working in this world of stand-up, I was isolated thinking, all I'm going to do is get back to Toronto. I have to tell him I love him before he meets somebody else and I blow it. So he had all this other stuff going on. And in my head, that tunnel vision was, I love you, I love you, I love you. I have to tell him. So we went back to his place and I remember telling him, what do you remember from the performance at Yuk Yuk's before we go?
I remember going well. I remember the set going well. And the fact that I don't remember being quiet, but that makes sense. I mean, I was, until I got to a point being really comfortable doing stand-up before I'd do a show, you're in your head. You're thinking, oh, what jokes am I going to do? And then, you know, you read the audience, you go to the club, you look, oh, okay, are they good, bad, what do they need?
But wait a second. So if you are on stage and the audience isn't really, do you have enough material really that you can switch directions?
No, at that point. At that point. Okay. I mean, I'd only been doing it six months. So I maybe had 3 minutes of good, solid jokes. Tops, 8 minutes of stuff that if the audience was great, I could go with.
So after that night, did you hope that that would open up doors that maybe the Last Resort wasn't, or was it just kind
of? No, because it really was at the time in Toronto that it was Yuk Yuk's versus the Last Resort. A bunch of the comics who were at Yuk Yuk's had left Yuk Yuk's to work at the Last Resort, and Last Resort was as younger comics, they were all my age, maybe a year or two older, but their humor was, I thought, awesome. It was clean. It was smart. It was intelligent. I like humor as well. That's kind of quirky and weird. And they were all that genre. Whereas Yuk Yuk's, there was a lot of great comics, but there was also a lot of, hey, guys are different than girls, right? How about this airplane food, folks?
So you were happy with the performance, but it wasn't like a career marker for you?
No. And
it was a bigger deal for me. I saw him at Yuk Yuk's with his mom.
Look, everything I do is a bigger deal for you.
Yes, yes. As we're about to find out. So I don't know if you remember going back to your place after the performance.
I do not. Once again, I don't remember. I remember the set going well. I remember who was there having a nice time afterwards, but I don't remember.
All right, so why don't we end this episode with my journal entry, because it's fantastic, once again, how PJ replies to my confession of absolute love.
Excuse the paper rustling here, but all right, so what's the date here? Oh, January 3rd, 1993.
This happened on December 22nd, just before Christmas.
Okay, so Nancy writes, so I saw PJ on the 22nd. We went to Yuk Yuk's with his mom, Nikki, and a friend of PJ's. He was very funny. The whole experience was wild. I met him at his place and he wasn't there. So then he came. He wasn't there.
I just let myself in somehow. Okay, I don't know.
Toronto's a safe city. We just leave our doors open for ex-girlfriends and anybody to come in. So they came in and looked great. Oh, I did look great, didn't I, back then? Oh, just the big pompadour of hair and well-dressed. Anyway, I watched TV for a bit while he got ready. I thought I was going to explode when he came in. I think he looks the best he's ever looked in his life. It's all downhill after that. So we weren't really talking a lot. I don't know if it was because he was going through his routine. Yes, that was why. Or what? My heart was pounding when he went up on stage, but he was great. Thank you. Afterwards, he went to the bar with Greg, that's the friend, and just laughed the whole night. PJ and I were sitting really close together and it was driving me crazy. He blew me away because he was touching me in the bar. Anyway, we took a cab back to his place and he just totally surprised me. He was so different to the way he usually was and brushed and flossed his teeth. What kind of an animal was I back then that I didn't brush and floss my teeth regularly?
I don't know. It just was a different...
Then he lit a candle. I can't believe I lit a candle.
Of all the revelations that ever come out of these journals, that could be the funniest.
I lit a candle. Yeah. I can't even, I don't even, I'm speechless. I have no idea why I even had a candle. Okay. I felt weird because it was like he was this smooth operator or something. Then when I asked him where we stood, I had my head on his chest and his heart was pounding. I don't know if he was happy that I told him I loved him or totally full of fear at the thought of commitment. I'm placing my bets on the second one. Before he answered, he asked me how it felt when I saw him up on stage.
Peach, I love you. Yeah. How was my performance?
Was I funny? Then he never answered my question because I was thinking, hey, does she think I'm funny? Then PJ just said, But yet I lit a candle.
I know.
When I was leaving the next morning, he said we could get together on Boxing Day. Boxing Day, for those of you who don't know, is the day after Christmas.
So we're going to leave it there, but it seemed a little strange to me that I've professed once again my love, that I love this person, and his doesn't reply at all, and then says, hey, let's get together in 4 days. Stay tuned for the next episode.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe and share comments on our social media. And remember, we want to hear your love stories, so get in touch. This podcast is a complimentary project to Nancy and PJ Learn French, a manuscript currently being shopped to publishers by our literary agent, Wendy York. Thanks to Isaac, Alista, and Dustin at Lifestuff Media. In our next episode, even though PJ did not reply I love you too after the Yuck Yucks get together in Toronto, Nancy is hoping for a Christmas miracle when he suggests meeting up again on Boxing Day.